Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the ICON Research Center at the University of Warwick. This is episode 25 and the third episode of our Journal of Management Studies Classics series, where we discuss three works, two articles by Joseph Porach, Howard Thomas, and Charles Clayton Fuller, one from 1989 called Competitive Groups as Cognitive Communities, and then an updated sort of reflecting version from 2011. Also, we have a 2011 paper by Sarah Kaplan where she reviews and reflects upon the research in cognition and strategy. To get the readings and find out more, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. My name is Dimitris, coming to you from Brighton in the United Kingdom.
And it is Pedro, coming to you from Brasilia, Brazil's capital.
And this is Tom, coming to you from Carlisle, Pennsylvania, in the United States.
And this is Ralph, coming to you from the high desert of Albuquerque, New Mexico, with snow on the ground.
Well, and this is Sarah Kaplan. I'm in Toronto, Canada.
Welcome, Sarah. We have another very special guest today, one of the authors of the paper, and we're so delighted to have you join us.
Thanks. Delighted to be here.
Wonderful.
So we might want to start giving our listeners a little background about Sarah. Oh, I'm sure that they, most of them will be familiar with her and her work already, but just for the record, Sarah is
for
a member...
one person.
Exactly. So Sarah is a faculty member at the Rotman School of Management in Toronto. She is best known for her work in strategic management, but has also been exploring the topic of gender and the economy. And she'll be here joining us today, helping us make sense of this classic work, given that she has written a very interesting reflection on the 20 years that have passed since this paper has been published and what happened in the field since then.
And to set us up for the conversation, I'm going to give a brief overview of the paper, the original paper by Porach Thomas and Madden Fuller, the Competitive Groups as Cognitive Communities paper. And from the abstract, the article explores how the mental models of organizational strategists determine perceptions of competing organizations and responses to competitive conditions. And this paper spawned the whole field of managerial cognition or managerial cognition. And it was actually created as a separate subgroup of the Academy of Management, which I learned from Sarah's paper. And I think maybe today there's a tendency to take some of these ideas for granted because this paper has been out for so long. But it was striking when they wrote the paper, and because the people had been looking at strategy from, say, material and technical transfers of information or goods, and nobody had really looked at cognition as a form or a way of developing strategy or how it was reflected in strategy. And in fact, the other challenge that the paper was attempting to address was that there was not a good way to discuss the reciprocal links between firm-level strategies and group-level structures, which is one of the things identified in the paper. And in the paper, they argue that a really important link between the group-level and firm-level competitive environment are the mental models that are used by the key decision makers to interpret the task environment of their organizations. And that because they're trying to understand how the firms think about strategy, it may seem obvious now, but was not then, that you have to look at this at a cognitive level. And the paper goes on further to talk about how the reality of the environment is not quite as important, or maybe not as significant, as what the decision makers think about the competitive environment, which, as a social scientist on my part, I thought was very interesting. And the last thing I want to say is that another interesting feature of the paper is they were trying to explore a really new idea with boundary-spanning research, and this is what this paper represents. And the authors themselves had a very diverse set of backgrounds that I think made them well qualified to look at this from a different perspective. They were a statistical decision theorist, a social psychologist, and an economist looking at strategy. So that's quite a multidisciplinary background for the writing the paper. So Sarah, did I get that about right, or did you want to add something?
There's plenty to add. in terms of just fleshing out the conversation. Would it be helpful for me to just give you a little background on kind of why I was drawn to the paper and what I learned when I started to, when I was asked to do the review?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes, please.
So of course, this paper, I'm interested in cognition. When I left my job at McKinsey & Company and went back to MIT to do my PhD, I knew what I wanted to focus on was mental models or interpretive frames or the ways that managers interpret what they do, because I had seen that to be so salient in my consulting work. And of course, one of the canonical citations was the Scottish Knitwear paper. You know, if you're interested in that, that's one of the first places that you go. And so I had always cited that paper in sort of the way of saying, yes, we know cognition matters for how strategy gets done, because the interpretations of the environment matter. And so I had always sort of cited it in that way, having read the paper and found it to be, you know, and understanding that it was one of the foundational papers in this field of managerial cognition, in particular, how it applies to strategy. But then when I was asked sort of to do this 20-year reflection by the editors at the Journal of Management Studies, I decided that one of the most useful things I could do was go back and look at what was the project of the paper at the time the paper was published, and to begin to understand what was the context that, you know, in the end makes this paper so revolutionary. And so part of what I do in the review is actually give some of that historical perspective, which is, you know, in part that in the 1980s, there had been a general increasing interest in the idea of cognition in general, in the interpretive side of organizations in general, in the field of management. Not so much in strategy per se, but in the field of management. And that was also followed by, you know, had followed sort of a groundswell of interest, again, in general, in cognition in the field of social psychology. So it's very salient that you mentioned that one of the co-authors of the article was a psychologist, because it's clearly drawing on that groundswell of interest that came in the world of psychology. But then they bring this into the world of strategic management. And they do a couple of things with the paper that really contributed to the conversations that were happening in the 1980s. The first was, of course, this was still prime in the time when people were talking about contingency theory and the matching of organizations to environments. Lawrence and Lorsch was sort of 20 years old, and it was still very much kind of this conversation about how do organizations match their strategies to the environments in which they operate. And, you know, there was a beginning to be the argument that the Scottish Knitwear paper made was that, in fact, their interpretations are going to matter for that. This is not just a process of figuring out exactly what the environment is and then matching to it, that, in fact, your understanding, your interpretation of the environment mattered. And that could be, you know, either because, you know, in a very sort of Carnegie School kind of way, that there's a cognitive limits of managers, or it could be the way some people argue that simply the environment is so fraught with uncertainty that, you know, it's not about our cognitive limits. It's about literally things are so uncertain that you just have to put a stake in the ground, and that's what cognitive frames would do. But the effect was basically to endogenize the environment, where prior research had basically said, you know, strategy is about matching to the environment. What they were doing was basically saying, no, the environment is as understood by management, and therefore it's the matching process is one that happens through the interpretive process. And so I think this was really what made this paper particularly salient. I think the other thing that made it really salient was the field of organization studies in general, I think, was very much had moved to a kind of position and situation kind of conversation. We were in the, you know, smack dab in the world of population ecology and transaction cost economics and resource dependence, which really thought of organizations as these kind of holes interacting with the environment. And what this did is said, no, managers matter. We have to look inside organizations, and we have to see what managers are doing. And not only are they doing matching, but the matching is happening through the interpretive process. So those are, I you know, when I got the task to write this review, the thing that I think was the most interesting to me was to go back and really think about what was their project at the time in the 1980s. And in fact, this paper came out of a conference that was held, which is a lot of when you have new emerging ideas. Often we know from research on conferences as field shaping events that there was a conference. They held a conference on this topic, and a number of papers came out that ended up in a special issue. This Scottish knitwear paper is the one that ended up being the most cited, but this was part of a, you know, a set of scholars who are all starting to think on the, along these lines. So that that gives you a little bit of kind of the background of the paper, what its project was at the time, because I think we understand the paper, as you rightly said in your introduction, we take a lot of these issues for granted now, mm-hmm. but at the time, no one was taking this for granted, and so they were really having these rich conversations in this conference about how, if we were to introduce an interpretive lens, what would that mean for our understanding of strategy? And this is one of the papers that came out of that.
This actually goes very nicely with the when we did that episode number 16, Lawrence and Lorch, one of the things that we were pondering and wondering about is what happens when the perception of organizations or other departments in that study of the environment is wrong. And that study didn't account for that. But here we have individual managers interpreting the environment and making decisions based on their interpretations, which kind of plugs the gap somewhat, and it's very interesting.
Right. I mean, it's definitely, you could definitely read this work as an extension of contingency theory, whether you look at Lawrence and Lorch or, John Woodward. They were basically saying you had to think about this match between the organization and the environment or the organization and the technology. And if you look at Woodward, it's more on the technological side. And what this paper has did, and you know what then 20 years of research since then, including my own, has done, has really tried to understand, well, what is that matching process exactly? How much does the interpretation of that, both the organization and the environment, actually matter for how you then make a strategic choice about how to act? And what they did in the Scottish knitwear paper is they actually found that when they went out and they used a methodology to elicit, you know, from the managers in the industry how they viewed their competition, what they found was that they were viewing their competition in a very specific way. That if you, as an outside analyst, looked at the industry, you might actually count the competition differently. For example, they only looked at Scottish knitwear manufacturers, even though there were other knitwear manufacturers that made similar quality products at similar price points that were competing in the retail outlets in the same way, but they did not count them as competition. And that's, if you were a pure strategy person, if you were a Michael Porter or even a Howard Thomas and the original a strategic groups research, you would think that the analytical stance would be the actual stance that managers took, but in fact managers took a different stance than maybe the external analysts would. And that's what was so interesting about what they found when they went and actually looked at how managers thought about their competition.
One of the things I thought was interesting, Sarah, was the, I don't want to say uniformity, but the alignment is probably the better way to say it, amongst the managers of the different firms. And they talk, in the paper, they talk about how they live within walking distance of each other many times, and there's some community association or group association meetings, or you could kind of imagine there are ways for that, some of that coherence to form. But I just thought that was striking, that they had that coherence amongst their views. So as you said, it wasn't the way kind of an outsider would look at it, but yet the insiders, even though they were different firms and competitors of each other, looked at the competitive environment similarly. Is that mm-hmm. Have you seen that sort of phenomenon in the other research that you've done?
Well, so there's a couple really interesting things to say just about the paper on that front, and then I can maybe come to my own research.
Yeah.
There's a couple of things. So one is, the paper then, given that kind of background that I just gave, the paper then really takes on this idea of strategic groups. So what had happened in the field of strategic management per se was we had Michael Porter publishing his book in 1980. In many ways, people count Porter's book, Competitive Strategy, as being sort of the the beginning of the official field of strategic management. And that book argued very much so that it was, you know, industry analysis that would tell you about performance. And then some folks like Howard Thomas came along and said, wait a minute, maybe there's some heterogeneity within industry, that there are, that high-level grouping at the industry level was actually omitting, you know, certain asymmetries that within the industry that could explain outcomes. And this comes to what is your competitive positioning within the industry, and there could be strategic, what they called strategic groups within the industry. So then what Howard Thomas then goes ahead and does with Joe Porak and Charles Batten Fuller is says, well, let's try to understand these strategic groups. And that's when they went and tried to look at how all the competitors saw who their competitors were. And as you point out, interestingly enough, almost all the Scottish knitwear players, you know, had a very, very similar way of identifying who their competition is. And the conclusion that they draw is that basically that, you know, they, it was a self-reinforcing process that the managers kind of looked at a certain set of data, and if they always look at the same set of data, they're always going to get kind of the same answer. And if they, the data is produced by the group of competitors in that small area, then, you know, that's, you basically, their networks, as you said, they're all nearby and all that kind of stuff. And even if they're competitors, they're obviously interacting in kind of industry activities, that that actually became their information filter. So over time, you know, you could imagine if they had done a historical study of Scottish knitwear, which would have had to go back several hundred years, I'm sure, they would have seen that notion of who the competition was kind of solidifying over time as those networks became self-reinforcing. So I think that's a really, it, you know, something that gets lost a little bit when people cite the paper now or think about the paper now. They don't think about that particular mechanism that they identified in this paper, which was sort of this self-reinforcing process that caused people to kind of filter down the data that they got. So I think, just reflecting on the point you made, I wanted to kind of say, yes, that was like a really important part of the project of the paper.
And I will tell you, that's something I resonated with, because as somebody who's very interested in culture and how it affects how people think and the social interactions, you know, I found that as striking. So I'm glad you emphasized that it was not kind of typical strategy papers at the time.
No, it wasn't. And I think that's why it ended up, you know, getting cited. Although if you look in the article that I wrote about it, I went back and looked at the citations to the article, and it did take a little while for interest to pick up. So the citation rates were, were slow for the first couple of years. And it was only sort of as we got 10 years out that you started to see people really starting to pay attention to the article, because I think the idea was kind of, the strategy field was, you know, wasn't going to buy it in the beginning, because they said, no, this is, you know, in a very Porterian way, this is about industry analysis, and, you know, this is an analytical process. And as Porter says in his book, you know, if you don't know the answer, do more analysis, basically. I'm paraphrasing, you know, and that's always been my beef with the Porterian argument, is like, well, yeah, you can do as much analysis as you want, but maybe someone goes golfing with his or her buddy and, you know, talks to someone and gets a different idea, and then that's the idea that's going to shape how they interpret all that analysis. So it took a while for those ideas that we've been emphasizing to really get picked up. I mean, of course, then it became an avalanche of interest in managerial cognition, but it took a while for that to kind of seep into the academy.
I'm not an expert in the area, but from what I have been hearing, it seems that almost this shift has provoked a more emic perspective, you know, instead of like, it's the position of view of the analyst, but more what the actors themselves sees the competition as relevant or not, which is, for an ethnographer like me, very interesting.
Yes,
but I just wanted to double check if that's, you know, my reading is correct.
Well, that's very interesting that you say that, because of course, as an ethnographer myself, while I do quantitative work, I also spend a lot of time in the field, and I think it is in some ways a more emic kind of approach, which says, let's not presume, how the managers are doing the analysis. Let's actually see how the managers are doing the analysis. So, mm-hmm. and you know, it's very interesting because one of the follow-on papers that I talk about was the, you know, the couple of or the series of papers that Joel Baum and Teresa Lant did on the Manhattan hotel industry. And one of the things they found, they actually did that explicit contrast between if you were doing the analysis, the external analysis of who hotel competitors should be, they get one list. And then if you actually go talk to the hotel managers, you get a different list. And they actually do that direct comparison and show that those that it's different and show that, it's very different when you're in the marketplace. You know, your interpretation of who your competition is. So I think, you know, you can see how subsequent work kind of picked up on that idea and said, let's actually compare that, the EDIC and the EMIC view in a way, if you want to use that language. So I think that's a really interesting insight.
I think it also tells us some interesting things about the nature of the term competition, because looking at it from the traditional strategic perspective, even as you repeatedly mentioned, folks like Porter, competition is an almost antagonistic state of industry that you fight it or you defend against it. But looking at this paper and also at what you just said about the Manhattan hotel industry, that competition seems as more of a nominal type of a relationship where it's self-supporting and thus grounding the way people interpret their industry and their work, as opposed to kind of grounding that against some sort of an objective environment, as would be the case with the traditional right. strategy research.
Well, and that's something that I think is a piece of the paper in the Scottish Network paper that did not, and I make a note of this in my article, is a piece that kind of didn't get picked up nearly as much as, in retrospect, when I go back and read their paper, that, you know, one of the most, to me, interesting things that they talked about are these cognitive oligopolies. And what they say is, you know, if you believe, you know, you think about oligopolies in marketplaces, that's, you know, an economic kind of concept. And the idea was that, you know, oligopoly, you know, if you're in an oligopoly, then you are constantly monitoring your competition and all that kind of stuff and kind of responding appropriately. And what they basically say is they reverse that causality, and they say that it's actually the inter-firm monitoring and coordination that creates the oligopoly rather than the oligopoly leading to inter-firm monitoring and coordination. And that's like, that's a pretty radical idea that, you know, doesn't, you don't see that being the idea that gets picked up from the paper, but very much follows on from the point that you just made, which is, you know, we're basically turning the whole direction of causality on industry structure and competition on its head.
I like that, because where would one show things like oligopoly or other macro structures that we study as organizational scholars, that they are not out there to be found, they are self-constructed, and these guys here show it in a very eloquent way, and right. you highlight it very nicely.
Yeah, I mean, in the cross-section, you would see, oh, there's an oligopoly, but the point is, how does that oligopoly get created, and how is it maintained? So you have to kind of move mm-hmm. beyond the snapshot kind of cross-sectional picture of the situation.
So I want to start trying to play a bit devil's advocate and trying to I don't want to say picking holes into the paper, but more, you know, try to engage more critically in a way.
So you just came back and you're going to be advocate.
He can't exactly. wait. That's what he does.
I'm known here in the podcast as devil's advocate, Sarah. So.
Well, that's good. I think we should definitely, as scholars, look at every piece of research that we read in a critical way. So I'm looking forward to that.
Okay, first thing, I really like the paper, but I feel that, or at least I wonder if many of the things that they are able to discover and put forward has to do with the specific case that you're looking at, because in a way it's a very almost quaint and extreme, you know, because you have this small industry that people seem to have a very sense of pride that is in a way intermeshed with national pride and all these kind of sort of things, is almost kind of like family-run business. So I wonder, in today's marketplace, in today's capitalism, these kind of, I don't know, processes would still be found. It's a provocation, because I feel that there are, but I wonder.
Which process are you referring to? The process of objectification of interpretations, or
this kind of very cohesive kinds of understanding and very kind of cohesive mental model that they all share. You know, this kind of, it's almost like if you went to a village and you have a very a culture in which everyone share something, some kind of values or ideas. You know, but I'm trying to say that, well, if you look in some villages, actually, there's a lot of disconnects and different ideas. So I would imagine that today there is not so much cohesiveness. Do you see my point?
Yep.
Well, so my reaction is, yes, I think it is a very special case. And I think it's, a wonderful case that they could look into, because I think it highlights the points very well. But we know from subsequent research that these dynamics play out in all sorts of places. So, you know, going back to the Manhattan hotels, that's not really a village. That's kind of an extremely cutthroat kind of Manhattan hotels. You can't get more cutthroat in terms of competition. Yeah. And yet what Joel Baum and Teresa Lant were able to do is really show, you know, even in that situation, the supposed analytical notion of who was your competition was very different from the way that the managers interpreted their competition. So I think we have quite a bit of subsequent research that shows that this is applicable in all kinds of settings. And, you know, we know this, you know, in all sorts of industries that, you know, companies that don't take seriously certain kinds of competition, and then that competition comes to eat their lunch. Right? You know, yeah, that happens all the time. Right. You know, for example, think of Walmart. You know, for a long time, Walmart, you know, it grew very quickly, but it grew in the southeast of the United States, and people didn't really, companies like Sears or companies like Kmart didn't really, you know, like they didn't really pay attention to them as competitors. And then it was just too late by the time, you know. So who you count as a competitor, I think, is incredibly salient, and is in all sorts of industries. And of course, if you go into the kinds of research that I do, where you're then intersecting that with the emergence of new technologies, you see that all the time of, you know, companies not taking seriously or thinking that their competition is some startup with a new technology. And then, of course, it becomes too late. So I yes, of course, Scottish Knitwear is a very special case. But I think what's appealing about the paper is that, in fact, the ideas translate quite easily into other contexts.
From what I learned, it's applicable even in situations that there is not such a sense of cohesive identity as these guys have in that industry. And also in other places that it's much more diversity and different ideas, there is still some processes that are common. Okay.
Yeah, or new identity. I mean,
yeah, I was going to give an example.
Oh, okay.
I was going to give an example, Sarah, because you were talking about that, the eating the lunch thing. I was thinking about traditional cell phone manufacturers, right? If you look back, so 2007 time frame when the iPhone came out, the dominant model was something like the keyboard, or you know, perhaps a BlackBerry or a non-graphical operating system. And many of those traditional vendors, Nokia, Ericsson, you know, those kind of people, didn't take the iPhone seriously, like you were describing.
Right.
And in fact, there's a famous quote from the chairman. I don't want to rub it in for the BlackBerry fans, but there is it's an interesting reflection of this sort of cognitive oligopoly thinking, because BlackBerry was dominant in the marketplace at that time, and said, "Hey, a cell phone without a keyboard is never going to catch on." Right?
Well, but I think there's a really interesting point that you're making, which is, I mean, the Scottish Knitwear was not looking at the emergence of any new technologies or anything like that. So I think, you know, what they were basically saying is just they see, you look out there and you could see, here's a whole bunch of nice sweaters that are knit by a whole bunch of different companies, and yet they only think that a certain subset of companies making those nice sweaters are really their competition. Mm-hmm. Now, when you then add in new technology, as I just did and as you just did, then that, I think that's a whole new flavor. It's certainly the area that I've done most of my research, and it's a lot of where the research moved to, but they were not talking about the situation where there's a new technology emerging. They were simply talking about in a fairly, stable industry as this was at the time, you know, how did they interpret who their competition was? And I think that would be the same thing with the Manhattan hotels. But then the interesting question comes up once you add in the emergence of new technologies and therefore new potential competitors who historically would not reasonably have been included, even analytically, in that industry definition, right? You wouldn't have historically put Apple in the competitive set for cell phones because they didn't make a cell phone. So once you come up with new technologies, then that adds this whole interesting new layer to things that, and I think that's where a lot of the research ended up going when we get into the late 90s and the early 2000s was saying, you know, let's now complicate this with the emergence of new technologies in a way that the Scottish Knitwear paper did not. That wasn't really the concern in this paper.
I kind of picked up from that paper that there was almost an implicit rejection of technology when they were talking about different types of sweaters and things, and they were showing this data from interviews where people were comparing themselves to Italian manufacturers, which of course is a different type of production technology, and they would just discount those as yes, that's nice, but that's not what we do. We do this other thing.
Right, exactly. So it wasn't so much about the emergence of a new technology, but they did categorize themselves according to which production technologies were used. Absolutely.
Yeah, I was going to go in a slightly different direction because one of the things that struck me about the environment, and when I think about similar industries that I witnessed in Europe a few years ago when I lived there, I saw a lot of the same kind of a pattern where you had a product that was localized. And what struck me about that was that other actors within the environment, such as the town, for example, the product was contributing to tourism in the town, which in turn, you know, reinforced the continued production of that product, and even some legal frameworks by which they tried to preserve the heritage of this particular product by certifying it as, okay, if it isn't from this particular location, then you can't, you trademark the town's name or something like that. And we've seen that in several products. So what that kind of led me to is an idea that there's a reinforcement of the environment of multiple actors that, you know, it sort of perpetuates this collective oligopoly or cognitive oligopoly beyond that of the manufacturer itself. And I was just wondering what your, do you sense that that's the case? And, you know, what do you all think about that?
I'm wondering whether maybe oligopoly is not quite reflective of what the knitwear people were doing in Scotland. I keep coming back to this association with more of an information aristocracy that they had going on. Because the information infrastructure that we've kind of covered briefly and that is in the paper, it's not, I don't know, to me, oligopoly implies a certain degree of purposefulness, that it's a situation where actors come together to influence or sort of bypass normal market conditions and processes, which...
No, I don't think that's the economic definition. I mean, it's not that they, quote,
that,
come together. I don't think they come together. It's that there is a state of limited competition. And, you know, it doesn't have to be. There's nothing in the definition of oligopoly that says that is purposeful. It just says that it's limited competition because there's a few, you know, dominant players. So, and I think that's what they're saying in this paper is that, in fact, because they defined themselves and saw themselves as a Scottish knitwear industry, they, you know, in certain ways, that the way they defined their competition then created kind of, it wasn't that they didn't compete against each other, but they didn't compete against each other in the way that you might if it weren't an oligopoly, in the sense of basically pricing down a marginal cost, you know, from an economic standpoint.
Right,
they didn't
do
that. They were protecting. And I guess to go back to the earlier point, I mean, I don't think this paper leads us to, you know, talk about things like should you, you know, trademark the town, when we know in wine and all sorts of other areas people have started to do, you know, have done for centuries, that kind of thing. I don't think that this paper leads us in that direction. But I think, you know, the point that they're trying to make in this paper is because of the way that they defined who their competition was, you end up observing, like if you were an economist going in, you would observe what would be counted by an economist as oligopolistic behavior. And what they're saying is the monitoring and the coordination that happens, and coordination, they don't mean coordination like we actually talk to each other and coordinate, you know, you coordinate all, you know, through price signaling, through all sorts of different kinds of things, that what they're saying is that's what led to the cognitive groups, not what, you know, was the cause of the coordination and the monitoring. I think that's the main point. But there's nothing about oligopoly that requires it to be intentional.
Yeah, I mean, be that as it may, still the paper is about looking at cognitive communities that result of competition. And communities are, of course, not anything that's monolithic or homogenous. And the data that they present, looking at the business volume of different knitwear weavers, manufacturers, that sort of shows that some of them are much larger than the others, which is why I kept coming back to this idea of that it's more aristocratic than oligopolistic, that there is more to do with the displacement of relative size and hence maybe a participation of the community.
Almost like a status, right?
Even the volume of production, right? if they're looking at themselves as a group that is not necessarily competing with one another, but has is putting out some sort of identity to the rest of the market, you know, the amount of stuff that is physically on the market will have a huge impact on what that identity is going to be perceived like. You see? So
I wanted to take this point to expand also to what I understood Neil was referring to, because when he said those things about the towns in Italy, I immediately thought about, they said towns in Europe, and I thought about Italy and the whole idea of made in Italy, because I think that in the paper, they discussed that one of the mechanisms that create these mental shared models are where the sources of the information, and they all different players have the kind of the same source of information, which is basically the agents that are selling their stuff, and they're the same kind of people, so they kind of have, you know, a common source, they have this common idea. So it's almost like an information processing thing, same channels, just shared thing. But I think there's also a more cultural side to it, you know, that kind of mental schemes come from these more cultural dimensions, and the so if you think about the made in Italy, it's very, very clear, but I think there's a similar thing happening here. The fact that they all see each other as this Scottish knitwear, and there is a kind of, you know, shared value, or whatever you want to call culture, that may happen in different, so it's a second order mechanism that is there, but they don't theorize as much. So I think that was interesting as well.
I don't think it's a criticism, but I do think Neo was onto that, something there, whether it's a trademark or not, so skip past that part, but this idea that the townspeople, right? And I think because you could say the firm, you know, workers in the firms have this kind of cultural identification that sort of that they absorb as well. And I just think it's an interesting idea. I'm not saying that paper was an error, but this how the culture actually expands wider to and I wonder, you know, I wonder if it also, Sarah, what do you think? So I get the idea that the managers are communicating with each other, and they have some self-reinforcing things or social processes that likely influence our cognitive maps. But I also wonder if, to extend Neil's idea maybe a little further, hopefully I'm not going the wrong direction, is that these social networks also include the townspeople, right? That also helps form this identity, and that you know, we're not competing on price, we're only competing on, you know, it's for a certain variety of customers. I'm just curious, what do you think about that? I mean,
well, it could be. I mean, that isn't something, as you said, it's not something that they studied in this paper, and not something that they theorized about. So I don't know that it's that. I mean, yes, it could be. There's all sorts of other reinforcing mechanisms, and that could be a question that one would ask, you know, subsequent to this paper.
Yes,
say, well,
yes,
this paper talked about the reinforcing mechanisms amongst the producers. I wonder, you know, how far those reinforcing mechanisms extend. And, you know, the way to make that question interesting, because if basically, yes, they're reinforced by the town and the culture, and you still get the same answer, then that's not very interesting. I think the only way that would become, you know, you could make that into an interesting question is if you found that, yes, they got reinforced by, say, the community or whatever, and even when for example, the producers wanted to change or refocus, they were sort of constrained by these other cultural or community terms, then that makes an interesting story. But if you're just saying, yes, it's also reinforced by them, then sure. So, you know, but
yeah,
so
what?
It doesn't change the story. It doesn't undermine the theorizing.
Yeah, and you said it much better than I would. So I appreciate you saying it, because that's actually what I was interested in, because, more reinforcement is not all that interesting. And it was this idea of what are the other implications? That's where it gets interesting, particularly the notion of whether it might restrain what they could go do. So I'll give an example. I think of that. So at the Pearl Harbor Naval Shipyard when I worked there, maybe I shouldn't have said that out loud, but we'll see. We were looking at changing the motto of the shipyard because it has a model that's in the Hawaiian language, and the motto is "Fit to Fight." We keep the ships fit to fight. And so the managers, when I was there, were looking at maybe this should be updated because we're not really in conflict all the time. Maybe there's more some appropriate modern aspect to this. And the outcry amongst the workers was tremendous. And they did not want to see any kind of a change down that path. And you could so maybe it wasn't just as simple as the motto. Maybe the model we could say, well, because we do different work, and here's what we should focus on and improve on, and our model ought to reflect that. I was astounded at how vehement the opposition and the sort of restraining force. So it could be. So I think that actually can happen.
Yeah, I mean, that's a single organization story, and what the Scottish Network paper is really focused on is kind of the competitors, like the competitive field. So it's it's kind of a different level of analysis you're looking at. But yes, I mean, I think it really speaks to why this paper has ended up being highly cited and why people do kind of just key off of it is that there are so many things that you could imagine based on, you know, all the possibilities that this paper opens up. You know, there are, you know, this paper was an early paper in the field. So it's based on, you know, a few number of firms and a methodology that involved eliciting these, you know, cognitive taxonomies, and you know, there's a lot of if you couldn't write this paper today, right? You couldn't get it published today because methodologically there's still a lot of issues, and there may be, as some of your questions are implying, there may be some alternative explanations that haven't been fully explored. But you know, that's why I think it's so important to situate this paper in 1989 in the project that they were doing then, because you know, they were simply trying to say, look, here's an explanation that's different from the explanations that others have offered. And, you know, and given that, and given that this was a really early attempt at trying to measure cognition inside, you know, in organizations, in and across organizations, you know, I think that that's the work that this paper does. And you're right, lots of people have imagined lots of things based on this paper and have taken it in lots of different directions, including trying to come up with better measures.
Right. So, well, I'd like to point out for our listeners that your paper does a wonderful job of that situation. So really, it'll help you to understand the paper better if you understand where it fits and where you've gone since by reading Sarah's paper. So that'll be very helpful.
Well, that was something that, you know, a lot, you know, you read sometimes review papers, and they review stuff sort of in the cross section, as if all papers were written at the same time, all the papers in a field. So you get these reviews in different journals, and they basically say, here's what the research says. And what I wanted to do in this paper, and I think I got a lot of latitude because it was meant to be a reflection on a particular paper, you know, kind of a really meant to be a look back, is try to do much more work to situate contextually the research. And I think one of the things that we don't do a good enough job of in the field is being clear when we're working with a particular paper, situating that paper in the conversation it was having at the time. And, you know, this paper is situated in very different conversations now than it was at the time that it was published, you know. And so I think it's one thing that I really enjoyed about this process was going back and kind of trying to be historical and explain, well, this is why we saw certain papers at certain times. And, you know, this paper in 1989 would not get published in 1999 or 2009 because by then the methods had moved on. By then we were more sophisticated. By then we had come up with some of these alternative explanations and said, boy, we really need to control for those or deal with those because we're not fully convinced. So, you know, that's why the situating it is so important.
Right, so Sarah, I have a question.
I was just going to follow up on that one part you had. Sarah, one of the things that I was curious about is when you were doing this situated review, what kind of jumped out at you? Because you know, I imagine that you, as you started the paper, you didn't have the full context yourself, and you learned through the process of doing the paper. So what kind of things jumped out at you as really kind of salient from this the process you went through of situating the paper?
Well, I think as I said earlier, one of the things that jumped out was just exactly what conversation they were in the 1980s, which I think I've reviewed already in this conversation.
Yes.
But the other thing that I found really interesting is when I went and looked at all the citations to the paper over the years, and I had, you know, 20 years of papers to look at, and what I saw was that, you know, in the first set of citations really was to those basic ideas about strategic groups and rivalry, which is really what they thought they were speaking to. They were really focused on this idea of strategic groups. But pretty soon that tapers off and it ends up being understood in the way that I understood it when I first cited it, as being about cognition in general, cognition and strategy, like that people quickly moved from the specific kind of work that the paper was doing, which is basically trying to show that that strategic groups were really cognitive strategic groups, like that's the project, to just saying, oh, cognition matters in strategy or cognition matters in organizations. And so another thing that was very interesting to me is to look at how people mobilize the paper over time. And that really, you know, the idea of strategic groups kind of, you know, now we maybe teach it in the MBA classroom, but we don't really research it so much anymore. And so that idea kind of fell away, but the paper continued to be really salient because it then became a case, and it wasn't about strategic groups per se, but when people cited it, it was a case of a way that interpretation then is shaping strategic choice and action. And that's, so it was interesting to me to see the shift between how people cited it, understood it and cited it in the earlier days, and how it is understood and cited now today, or, you know, at the time I did the review through 2009.
I have a very little question, and I think it's more in your capacity of senior editor. I'm not sure if you still are in your organization side, but I know that you have been for many, many years.
I still am, yes.
Okay, great. Which is more about the structure of the paper, not so much as the content, because when I read it, you can see there is a very classic genre, very different, you know, from the way that the methods are, well, not even presented, but the way the findings are presented. And, you know, there's something, today we could just criticize and say it's not very scientific or it's weird or something like that. But I kind of appreciate the very kind of, I don't know, almost economical kind of stories, are very focused on the case, very focused on what is relevant, you know. So I wonder if you, like, in your capacity as an editor, is something in the paper that you see as a strength of this earlier way of writing, or for you, we just got better? You know, something to be preserved, or it's all better now?
Well, I mean, so this was early in the life of Journal of Management Studies. It was early in the life of strategy research. It was early in life of cognition research. This was in a special issue. Special issues always get to have their own personalities and approaches to how you know, understand methods. So I, you know, I think, I mean, it is lovely to read in the way that you've just described, but I, you know, I don't think this paper would get published today, in part just because we have gotten much more sophisticated in management research. Our standards are different. We do have, you know, more rigorous ways of analyzing qualitative data. We, you know, and, you know, by the way, they have the 1989 paper, but then they went ahead and did a paper for ASQ in 1995 with some additional co-authors where they did do it, you know, where they did a whole questionnaire and they basically did the whole study, but much more rigorously, because I think once the point was made, then they could build on, you know, then they were like, okay, now let's do this study, quote, right, you know what I mean, or more rigorously, with more robust data. So, you know, so I mean, and that's why I say, I think we have to have different standards for papers that are, you know, really opening up a whole new conversation than for papers that are later trying to refine or validate or introduce a new measure or something like that. And the Scottish Knitwear paper opened up a new conversation. And so our standards are different because we're enough excited about the ideas that we're willing to overlook some of the methodological flaws.
So would you say that we as a cognitive community developed new categories in response to these forms of competition?
What do you mean by new categories?
Well, I'm this is my not so covert way of trying to move towards talking about categories.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yes. Well, let's talk about categories.
Also known as cognitive frames, schemas, or technological frames, of course. And so the deal with categories is that the Scottish knitwear study showed how categorizing different competitors affected strategic choices, right, of the firm. Mm-hmm. And they looked at how links between these categories and associations affected performance. And that's very interesting. And I think in your paper you were talking about how products that are clearly categorized sell better or persist longer as opposed to those that are vaguely vaguely categorized. And I think that's super interesting, not least because of the connections that it draws with this whole interpretative process that we alluded to and might still come back, but also what it tells us about the way in which these transactions kind of occur, that the role of category, a strong category rather, is, seems to be very fundamental to the entire functioning of the market.
Even when I wrote this review, when I was writing it in 2010, the categories, the body of research on categories was, you know, just more emergent. And, you know, now today there's a huge, huge body of research on categories that has made a whole bunch of very subtle claims.
And that's all for part one of episode 25. Thank you so much for listening. I think you can agree that Sara is an amazing guest, and we really hope that you're enjoying this conversation as much as we are. Now, remember to subscribe to our newsletter that you can find by going to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com, and that will help you follow the podcast as well as shed some light on the various events that are going on and some of the things that are happening in and around the podcast. Next week, we continue where we left off at the question of categories. So please do join us as we finish up the discussion on this third JMS classic here on Talking About Organizations.